We're going to get motivated today. There was this lovely trend in the 90s of having motivational posters up in workplaces. They include a beautiful picture and a pithy wee saying to help you get focused and do amazing things. We're going to look at a couple. Believe and succeed. Success, it says at the bottom, success is a journey. Whatever your path, it is your determination to succeed that will get you there. See, and you always all feel better already. The next one, make it happen. Some people want it to happen. Some people wish it would happen. Others make it happen. That's Michael Jordan, he would know. And the third, excellence. It is a commitment. It is an unrelenting pursuit of your goals. It will enable you to achieve greatness. Ordinary is not an option. Everyone wants it, but are you willing to hunt for it? See what they did there with the lion and the hunting. See, now you can go out and just achieve anything you like. Not sure. These sayings indicate our current common wisdom about life. If you want something enough and work hard enough, you'll achieve it. Go and make it happen, you excellent people. Well, today, we're going to be looking at a passage in Mark in which Jesus goes quite strongly against common wisdom. The passage we're looking at is at the end of the chapter 8 of Mark. Now, leading up to this passage, Jesus once again fed a large crowd of people with very little food. He refused to show signs to the Pharisees who were asking for one. He warned the disciples about the bad influence of the Pharisees and Herod. He healed a blind man at Bethsaida. Peter declared that Jesus was the Messiah, and Jesus foretold his death. After Jesus tells of his death and resurrection, Peter tries to tell him off. Very Peter. Presumably because he can't imagine Jesus suffering, or perhaps he was just very scared of losing him. But Jesus will have none of it and rebukes Peter, saying, "You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." This statement about thinking about human things rather than divine things is really key to understanding the passage that we're going to be looking at today. So lock it away. You can do it. You're all excellent. Let's start by reading the passage in Mark 8. It's at the very end of the chapter, verses 34 to 38. He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Mark starts this passage a little bit differently to his normal structure. He usually starts with Jesus talking to his disciple, to the big crowd. I'll get it right. He starts with the big crowd, and then he moves to a private discussion with the disciples. And here he starts with his private discussion with the disciples and moves to the big crowd. Jesus called the crowd with his disciples. And this indicates that the message here is for everyone, not just the disciples, not just the church leaders or those in authority. It's for the whole crowd. This is an everyone message. And it's reinforced in his first few words, "If any wish to come after me." It's a message for everyone. So when Jesus gives these instructions, we need to pay close attention to what he's saying. What he's saying in this passage is a hard thing. It flies in the face of conventional wisdom, social norms, and much of what is taught in the church today. I'm thinking particularly of the prosperity gospel nonsense. in order to have a clear understanding of what's being taught here, we're going to be looking at the meaning of words and such, which I love, but I know it's not everyone's favourite thing. So I am going to try and make it as interesting as I can. Jesus starts by saying, "If any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." This first statement is a clear instruction. If you want to follow Jesus, if you want to walk the same path as him, not just be an observer or an admirer, you need to first deny yourself. Some teach that this means giving up everything that might give you a measure of pleasure, and that is not what is being taught here. Jesus is saying that we need to give up not mere things, but ourselves as the focus of our lives. We need to stop making ourselves the top priority, the center of our own universe. We need to shift the center of gravity of our lives from us to the will of God. There is no specific list of things to give up. Neither is there just one season for giving things up, like Lent. This is an attitude of the heart, something that Joe spoke about last week. This denial of ourselves is a Christ-focused life that centers itself around being open to God's initiatives and control. I think this is such a difficult thing for us to comprehend. We are taught openly that we need to think mostly about ourselves and what makes us happy. I had a friend in my early 20s who was contemplating divorce after only 1 year of marriage. And her counselor was encouraging her to think about what was going to make her happy without any regard for the other person or any circumstances or children. We live in an individualistic society that makes self top priority in every decision that needs to be made. And then we complain about how inconsiderate of others people are. But Jesus is calling us, as ever, to something different from the norm. He is asking us to think not about human concerns, but about divine concerns. This idea of denying ourselves, of shifting the focus of our life away from our own desires, is something we need to actively work on. If we want to make Jesus the center of our life, we need to get to know him. It's not going to happen just from thinking it's a good idea. We need to get to know him through his word, through prayer, through connection with other believers. We need to make the things of God important in our lives so that when we're encouraged to make them a priority, we actually know what they are. This verse also includes a call to take up our cross. If you want to follow Jesus, take up your cross. Following Jesus is Mark's definition of what it means to be a Christian. And Jesus is not leading us on a pleasant afternoon hike, but on a walk into danger and risk. For the people Jesus was speaking to at this time, taking up your cross only meant one thing. A condemned person carrying a crossbeam upon which they would be nailed at the place of execution. By the time Mark wrote this account, it had taken on a new meaning. It was also a reference to Jesus' crucifixion, and it would have reminded the early readers of the mass crucifixions of Christians by Nero, Titus, and Vespasian. There was nothing metaphorical about taking up your cross to the early church. The commitment Jesus is asking for is a willingness to stand firm in the faith and the mission of God to the point of death. Christianity is not a matter of private devotion and showing individual kindness to others in private. Commitment to Jesus is participation in the mission of the church. active, public testimony and identification with Jesus that could draw the attention of the authorities. Jesus is asking us to stake our very lives on the pursuit of God's will. It is all too easy to soften this point to a metaphorical cross or a piece of jewelry. I've got one. We think of it as everyday inconveniences of life and claim that they're our cross to bear. But it's not the point. We are not just enduring the inevitable pains of life. We are asked to choose to pick up our cross and share in the suffering involved with discipleship and mission. Death on a cross was excruciating, public, and therefore humiliating. What public and humiliating pain are you willing to endure for the sake of the gospel? The next statement Jesus makes is verse 35. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. This statement is quite counterintuitive. Most people trying to save their life are trying to save it. If you're trying to lose your life, inevitably it will be no more. But we need to keep in mind Jesus' statement to Peter in the previous verse. You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Now, I noticed in this verse that the words save and lose are repeated. And because I'm a big old nerd, I started to wonder if they were the same words in Greek. So I looked it up. The word for lose is the same both times. It means to destroy fully, and it can be literal or figurative. The words for save are very subtly different. I just about ruined my brain trying to get my head around Greek verb construction because it's been 23 years since I studied it. Oh, and I'm not going to bore you with like aorist infinitive actives because it's really hard to explain and really boring. So I'll just go straight to my conclusion. The conclusion I came to from my study is that the first save, for those who want to save their life will lose it, is a one-off at some undefined point, maybe, action. It seems to imply that if you try to save your life, if you hope or want to save your life, with no real guarantee of it actually happening, then you will definitely lose it. The second save, for those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it, is a real or certain action that would definitely take place in the future. If you choose to put your life on the line for the sake of Jesus and his gospel, then Jesus guarantees that your life will be safe. This is one of those hard truths that Jesus struggled to get his disciples to see. He came to make things new and different. He came to change hearts and connect heaven to earth. He came to seek and save and serve. He promised us life and persecution. When I was in my early 20s, I read a book called God Has a Wonderful Plan for Your Life, The Myth of the Modern Message by Ray Comfort. And this is a blurb from the book. For decades, the world's most popular gospel message has been drawing the lost by promising God's wonderful plan for their life. But behind the facade of the wonderful plan message is the reality of the trials, temptation, and persecution that Jesus promised. Ray Comfort wrote this book to point out the unbiblical nature of claiming to unbelievers that God will make your life more pleasant. He tells a story in the book that illustrates the difference between trusting God to make your life more pleasant and trusting him to deliver us from hell. I'm going to read it to you. Two men are seated in a plane. The first is given a parachute and told to put it on because it will improve his flight. He's a little sceptical. He can't see how wearing a parachute on board a plane could possibly improve his flight. After some time, he decides to experiment and see if the claims are true. He straps on the parachute. He notices the weight of it on his shoulders, and he finds that now he has difficulty sitting upright. However, he consoles himself with the flight attendant's promise that the parachute will improve his flight. He decides to give it just a little bit of time. As the flight progresses, he notices that some of the other passengers are laughing at him because he's wearing a parachute. He begins to feel a little humiliated. As they continue to laugh and point at him, he can stand it no longer. He sinks in his seat, unstraps the parachute, and throws it on the floor. Disillusionment and bitterness fill his heart because, as far as he's concerned, he's been lied to. The second man is also given a parachute. But listen to what he's told. He's told to put it on because at any moment he'll have to jump out of the plane at 25,000 feet. He gratefully puts the parachute on. He doesn't notice the weight of it on his shoulders, nor is he concerned that he can't sit upright. His mind is consumed with the thought of what would happen if he jumped without the parachute. Let's analyse the motives and result of each passenger's experience. The first man's motive for putting on the parachute was solely to improve his flight. The result of his experience was that he was humiliated by the other passengers, disillusioned and somewhat embittered against those who gave him the parachute in the first place. The second man put on the parachute solely to survive the jump to come. And because of his knowledge of what would happen to him if he jumped without it, he has a deep-rooted joy and peace in his heart, knowing he's been saved from certain death. This knowledge gives him the ability to withstand the mockery of the other passengers. His attitude towards those who gave him the parachute is one of heartfelt gratitude. When we see Jesus as a magic genie here to make our experience of life pleasant, we will be disappointed. We will lose our faith. When we strive to save our life and keep from being hurt and keep from being humiliated by the crowds, we will, in the end, lose it. Now, we are not being asked here to go and jump out of a plane. What we are being asked to do here is to hold to the things of this life loosely. If we spend all our time trying to make this life better, then we will not be so very useful for the kingdom of God. But if we focus wholeheartedly on the will of God and his great commission to us, go and make disciples, then the things of this earth take their proper place. The things of earth are not the end goal, but the tools to be used for the furthering of God's kingdom. They are not what we are seeking, but what we are using for his glory. People seem to think that if you are denying yourself and losing your life, then you can't have nice things. This is not the case either. There are people all over the world who have nice houses, nice cars, nice holidays, and they work tirelessly for Christ to spread the gospel. I mean, there are also people who have all those nice things and they say, thanks God for the stuff, and do nothing for the kingdom. What Jesus is saying is that we need to be focused on the gospel of Jesus, and then whatever we have takes its proper place in our lives. The next two verses say, for what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? This is a continuation of that previous sentiment. Jesus asks this rhetorical question, which means you should know the answer. Is there any benefit to gaining the whole world if you're just going to die? Is there any amount that you can pay in order to save your eternal soul? And hopefully you all got the answer, no. When we were in Dunedin, Jeremy was able to interview Brad Thorne. Brad had an extraordinary rugby career, rugby union and rugby league, and this is part of his story. In his early 20s, Brisbane Bronco, that was the team he played for, Brad Thorne says he already had it all. A massive contract. I believe he had a $1 million contract at 19. A house, cars, money, attention. He was living the dream, but soon found it surprisingly empty. While he loved his sport and the camaraderie, he says a lot of people think if they can just be rich and famous, then everything will be good. I went there and it was empty. There was no fulfillment. And even though I had goals, I had no real sense of purpose. At the age of 23, he found himself sharing a room with teammate Jason Stevens, a committed Christian. The two talked about many things, including faith. And while Brad had been to church as a kid and had some belief, this was the time, he says, I surrendered my life to Jesus. Brad's life changed dramatically, and his decision wasn't popular with many of his peers at the time. He says, I didn't talk about it much at all, except if someone asked me. I never preached or spoke about my faith in the early days. I just lived my life. But it was a pretty radical change, and people noticed. It didn't go down well. He stopped his binge drinking, he stopped his partying, he stopped being entirely selfish. Brad had everything the world tells you is important, and he found it empty. He found his life change when he focused on Jesus and his mission. He still had his contract. He still had his fame. He still had his goals. But he had Jesus at the center. The things he had took their proper place. And now he travels the world telling people about the difference Jesus makes in his life. He is now living out Matthew 28, 18 to 20. In the final verse of this passage, Jesus identifies the single greatest barrier to sharing the gospel of Jesus. Those who are ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father and with the holy angels. I did some more dictionary Googling, because I do. Ashamed, I'll read it to you. Reluctant to do something through fear of embarrassment or humiliation. I think the most common reason we don't tell other people about Jesus is because we are worried they will mock us. We don't want to feel humiliation or embarrassment. They're uncomfortable. We care far more about what others think of us than of what God thinks of us. We care about our reputation rather than what Jesus has given up for us and given us. My T-shirt today says 116. It's a T-shirt I've wanted for a long time, but they don't ship to New Zealand, so I've made one. It's a reference to Romans 1:16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes. God has given his only Son to die publicly in shame and pain for my sin. The Spirit raised him from the dead and in that conquered death. And Jesus ascended to the right hand of the Father, where he intercedes for me day and night. And yet I often care more about what people think of me than Jesus. I confess that I sit on the wrong side of this. When I'm telling a story about my life, I take out the bit that mentions I was praying. I omit the prompting of the Spirit when I'm sharing something I've gone through. It is something I've been made aware of and something that I am trying to work on. It doesn't feel nice when people stop talking to you because you add Jesus into your conversations. It doesn't feel nice when people say mean things about you because of decisions you've made in your attempt to follow Jesus. It doesn't feel nice when people misunderstand you because of their own perceptions of Christianity. But I'm pretty sure that hanging naked on a cross with a back ripped to pieces and a crown of thorns didn't feel very nice either. Jesus knows what it is to be despised and rejected. He knows what it feels like to have friends turn away from you. He knows what it feels like to have people misunderstand you. He was called a liar and a blasphemer and the devil. Jesus knows. He's not asking us to do something he didn't do himself. And you might say, yes, but he's God. And I say, yes, but he's also fully human. That is the wonder of the incarnation. God became man. He really does get it. He is asking us not to go somewhere unfamiliar to him. He is asking us to follow. He has been there before. He's asking us to make him the top priority in our lives. He is asking us to pursue the will of God rather than making us the most important things. He is asking us to not be ashamed of him. Instead of a bunch of motivational posters or a verse taken out of context, perhaps we could put Romans 1:16 somewhere prominent in our lives. Perhaps instead of waking up to a picture of a cat saying we can be anything we want to be, we can look at Romans 1:16 and say, today, I will not be ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God that brings salvation to anyone who believes. I made a motivational poster. Oh, can we have the poster? Is there one more slide? I've got it up in my office. If you want a copy, I can email it out. We are going to end our service this morning. It was a nice short sermon. Oops. This is such an important thing that God is asking us to follow, to not be ashamed, to live our faith out loud, really loud, noise complaint loud. And I just wonder if, while we sing the final song, we could think about renewing that commitment to follow Jesus openly, loudly, on our t-shirts. It's confusing enough that people can ask, and then because they asked, I can tell them about the gospel of Jesus Christ. While we sing this song, maybe it's the first time you've considered that you might like to follow Jesus. Maybe you've been saying thank you, God, for the stuff and forgetting to follow Jesus. Maybe you're just really excited to follow Jesus. Most people here today love Jesus. It is a great place to practice being unashamed. And if you would like to commit to following Jesus or renew your commitment to Jesus, we've got a whole empty seat up here. And I would love to pray with you. Music team, if you could come up. We're going to sing I've Decided to Follow Jesus. Love this song. So easy. If you don't know it, very repetitive. Super, super easy. Or you can just be in prayer and then no one will know that you don't know it. But while we sing, if you'd like to come up, join me in a renewed commitment to follow Jesus loudly. Please do. Let's practice being unashamed for our God who gave everything.